Good afternoon. Mark, I wanted to say thank you very much on behalf of myself, my wife, and Isaac, who's probably polished off most of the grapes, for looking after us and your dear lady. Thank you to all. Chris, thank you, dear brother, for bringing me along. And if I can just echo your sentiments when you asked me to come along. Not am I only a servant of the living God of Jesus Christ, but also a servant of Barnabas Fund, and I'll try and allude as to how they've kept us under a roof, actually. I go back with Brother Patrick, as I affectionately call him. I love and respect him as a father, and I know that he's gone through a very rough time. Please do not read into some of the stuff that's gone on, because I myself stand here actually duped, actually failed by fellow Christians in the church, and in our deepest distress walked along and being criminalized. I actually stand before you with criminal convictions. It's just a measure of how it is for us as a convert family, suffering for over 17 years with the very loud voices of Islam and my fellow Pakistani Muslim family. This is the reality of the gospel and what we've been called into. I'm born and raised here in 65 in Birmingham, in this country. I'm classed as a first generation of immigrants born in this country from a Mirpuri background. And overall, you'll find the bigger population of Muslims from a Pakistani background are from a Mirpuri background. So I would fit into that equation. I came to know Christ through my school friend, John Lennon. God bless him, wherever he is. I haven't heard from him for decades now. I'm fast hitting that 52 mark. I don't like it, but I receive it with grace. I don't move around that squash court like I used to with my son, and this one's forever taunting me, Isaac, that I'm an old man now. But as a 15-year-old, it was through the life change of this friend of mine, previous skinhead, bother boy, racist, openly. We're all in awe of him, actually, us sort of, Pakistani school friends and such like. And then, he'd go away for long periods of time. He'd be collared, by the authorities, brought back to school. Very hard and streetwise, young man. And actually, working the bull ring, the shopping centres and all, and sort of, if you know Birmingham, you'll know sort of the bull ring, actually, which doesn't exist now. And anyway, it was one occasion that he is now sitting in classroom, brought back on such an occasion, tattoos are covered, Mohican hairstyles gone, the ear piercings from his sort of ears right down to his nose have all gone, civilized dress, and actually reading the Bible every given opportunity, and it literally just blew me away. And I just ascertained that has to be the power of God. And he's telling me now he's a born-again Christian, very, very approachable, warm, loving. And I was just riveted, to John. And as I say, he's telling me he's a born-again Christian. What's a born-again Christian? And so he'd expound. We'd spend hours talking. And he imparted to me a New Testament, a Gideon sort of pocket Bible. My early recollections of Christians and Christianity, the Bible, it's a lie. And it's a big taboo thing. So nevertheless, I took it and I hid it in my bedroom, and evenings I would read the gospel message. And it was whilst reading the gospel, four gospels, that I just saw this Saviour, Jesus. And I believe it was the Holy Spirit of God that touched me in my bedroom when I came to the knowledge of Jesus Christ. And through our long discussions, he said to me, "We'd like to meet my pastor." And I said, "What's a pastor?" And he said, "You know, this is what a pastor is. Come along and meet him." And funny enough, he wasn't living that far away from me at the time. So a 10-minute brisk walk. And the second most amazing thing was that the pastor, Joseph Patoy, God bless him, I haven't heard from him for many, many decades, and he also was a born-again sort of believer from a Sikh background. And I could just picture the gospel message for all people. And he would, again, you know, start off with a few hymns or songs, play his guitar, expound the word. And I actually eventually was baptized in his bath. I thought I was the only Christian. And I often say this, that, the boiler, I don't know what happened, it started throwing in cold water. And he dunked me in this freezing cold bath. And would you believe it, when I came out, I that warm, glowing feeling, you know, I'll never forget it, actually. So I'm now this secret believer. Actually, I thought I was the only one in the world. And I would go along on a Sunday, and we'd have fellowship together and such like. And this went on for a few months, short space of time. And I think there's definitely a change, you know, once Christ touches your life. And of course, my mother must have picked up on something. But certainly, one morning I remember waking up, and as I stepped out my bedroom door, and she was screaming and tearing the place down, accusing me to go to my father with the Gideon New Testament that they found. Presumably I'd read it sort of as I was reading, fell asleep, and there it was on my sort of laying on my chest, and she actually picked it up and would have gone to my sisters, and then they would have said to her, shock horror, "Oh my God, he's a Christian, look what he's got, you know, in our home." And when she threatened to go to my father, you know, a big man, rule with a rod of iron. I'm one of the smaller guys in my family, actually, you know. My father was a big man, actually. They're all sort of 6'4". And I was just literally terrified, and I was paralyzed with fear, and I never went back to the fellowships. And the rest is that, as we come to know that I was backslidden, and I didn't eventually come back to the Lord until, very sadly, through my brother's death, Iftikhar. He died very suddenly at the age of 29. In actual fact, he was addicted to codeine Linctus, the cough mixture that the GP, my dad's pal, this Indian chappy, was giving him repeat prescriptions for the fun of it. And by the time he was 15, so 2 years on, he was drinking 2 pints of it a day until he literally dropped dead, actually. Very, very painful, traumatic experience. I've never known pain like it, actually. My father was semi-retired at the time. I had moved to Bradford for various reasons, and my kid brother phoned me up. He was distraught, and he said, "Iftikhar's died. Mother's in hospital. She's been suffering her asthma because of the anxiety of Iftikhar, who'd become a recluse by now, really had resigned himself, that he was going to die, I suppose." We didn't realize that he'd been suffering immeasurably all these years, and you know, his organs literally packed up, and he died of acute necrotizing pancreatitis. It's a very, very serious thing to have, and I was told by the GP it's one of the most excruciating pains a human being can endure. And I remember my kid brother telling me that he couldn't stand the wailing in the house and used to cry out to God. Incidentally, he came to Christ at the same time as I did, together. And so I'm comforted by the fact that, you know, he's in the arms of the Lord, you know. So often we don't feel that we, you know, are winning the battle, but the victory is the Lord's, you know, and it took me many years to get over that. But actually, at the time, I went to Birmingham, and a week later, they released his body, and my father, who was semi-retired in Kashmir, and said to me, bringing his body over to me. And so naturally, I obeyed, and I took his casket, along with my mother and family members, to Pakistan. They have their own burial yard. And it was whilst they were lowering his casket that I said, Lord, you know, I've been running for so long. I've been ducking and diving. And it's a matter of time before, you know, I'm 6 foot under. And I really want to make it right with you. So I made a confession of faith. And I never looked back, actually. And a few weeks later, my wife confronted me and said, you're going to church. And that sort of knocked me sideways. You know, she's born and raised in Pakistan. I had a typical arranged marriage. And so I couldn't understand how she found out. But when I said yes, her natural reaction was to recoil and pull our two oldest kids, who were sort of 4 and 2 respectively, and to tell me never to come back again. But, you know, the Lord done a work through some Christian brethren at church who invited me over with my wife, and I'd get sitting about sort of inviting, giving her this invitation, say, look, you know, I've got some Christian people that want to invite us. And eventually she mellowed, and of course there was despite my brokenness, there was a real change in my life. And so we ended up going to this couple. Her husband had been a missionary some years prior, and they introduced us to a Pakistani Christian couple who ran a Pakistani Christian fellowship, and I couldn't believe it. You know, it was the best thing since sliced bread. And so it was through that interaction that eventually, through another church service, that my wife gave her heart to the Lord, and we've never looked back since, so to speak. So we were a complete family now in Christ. No sooner, this is in 96, so I'm talking around about sort of mid-96, that I confessed to a Pakistani friend of mine, born and raised in a country like myself, that, look, you know, I am now a Christian. And when he heard that, actually, he looked dumbfounded, but then he said to me, Nisar, I never want to see you again. I don't want you coming near my doorstep. And that's it. You know, we're finished. So through him, obviously, he's then told one or two other friends. And next thing I know, it's gone out like wildfire. And as a result of that, actually, that people around us soon found out. It wasn't a predominant Muslim area. However, what you find is that then it infiltrates, it goes into the school where some of my wife has been confronted by. And the gentleman in the back there, the brother there, mentioned about the sort of various categories of Muslim tolerant or intolerant. But in essence, you are now outside of the Ummah, the Islamic Brotherhood. And so you have different sort of like Pashtuns, Pathans, Afghanistanis to you and I, who are quite stringent compared to the Pakistani Muslims. Very conservative, very stringent, you know. I know people actually who've been in conversation from a Pathan background have said, since their parents especially the mother, have landed in this country in the early 60s, they've never even been to the local town, for example. All they've done is sort of, you know, had children and just been in the confines of their home, maybe to another house, relative, and shrouded, you know, in the burqas and whatever, when they leave the doorstep. And that's the life they've ever known, actually, just to give you an idea as to how, you know, even in this country, how, you know, conservative they can be actually. So my wife, Kubra, would get confrontations from these women. Why don't you wear a miniskirt now that you're Christian? So she'd be sort of defending Christianity in a court and say, well, what do you mean, miniskirt? Well, you're a Christian now, you know, wear see-through blouses or a miniskirt. And, you know, so she was quite sort of taken aback. She said, well, look, hold on. First of all, I'm born and raised in Pakistan. This is my culture. And actually, you know, this I'm not going to change, you know, my dress. I mean, she's been quite moderate even when she came to this country in her dress. But so it's that kind of perception that they have of, you know, this kind of low perception of Christian women or Christians per se. And so it literally, what it boils down to, it's instant contempt, actually. And you are very much isolated. And not only are you isolated, but then it becomes, you're ridiculed, mocked. You know, you're absolute scum of the earth, actually, you know. So where you might have this wonderful brotherly relationship, sort of one second, the next second, there is just this instant contempt. You're done with, finished, no more sort of comings and goings or greetings. It's things like this, actually. You know, in a nutshell, there is no tolerance. Regardless of how the nations have been duped, the Western nations, there is no tolerance. You might get one in a million who's happy to talk to you and dialogue, actually. But again, you know, he dare not sort of take you back to the home where the parents are, whatever. You're just doomed. And so, you know, it's a double-edged sword. And again, going back to your question, that if I can tie it in, that, you know, they are takia, deception. It's very much ingrained in Islam. It's literally in them, actually, that they can just deceive and lie their way through, and they are so very, very convincing. The average Westerner would have no concept as to the cunning, the deception, lies, and again, it all sort of boils down to Muhammad and some of the decrees, you know, and here we can see now, while I'm growing up, there is no intolerance, you know, but when you become the majority, you enforce Sharia, and this is the problem that we have now. Maybe I can try and allude to that a bit later. Nothing has prepared me and my wife, even though she's born and raised in a Muslim country, that after the jeering and the mocking becomes confrontational, it then becomes actual damage to your cars. I've lost count the time. I've had 3 cars written off, rammed, torched outside my home, drive-by brickings. We couldn't sit the children next to the window, the bay window. We didn't know where the next brick was going to come flying from. We used to call them drive-by brickings. And you are literally now on the front line in the trenches. And this went on for several years by young men who were literally like Isaac's age, who we saw grow up, who had now become young men in their teens, and groups of them, and whereby they're calling my wife every name under the sun, the most degrading, demoralizing names, actually. And if the boot was on the other foot, there'd be war, actually. They'd want to kill you for honor, for you know, for saying that against their women. It's just this complete impunity, you know, this lawlessness by which they go by, without any recrimination of the law, the police. And I would be here too long to try and express to you where mobs have been outside my home. In one instance, I had to literally run in, fight for my life, actually, run into the house. I had no choice but to pull out the biggest kitchen knife I could find, Chris. Go running out because I couldn't afford to have them rampage my home while my wife held a newborn baby in her arms. And by the grace of God, a couple of police cars is this instance in the early years. But they were surrounded. They mobilized the police, and thankfully they then sort of sent back up, and then we had riot vans coming. They were making open threats. They were going to kill me. They were going to do this in front of the police. And I actually said to the police lady, can you not hear what they're saying? You know, and these were some of my neighbors. Anyway, they arrested these people. This is one example out of, you know, 17 years of experience of going through this. And then before you know it, because of the uproar, they've come back and arrested me. So I've been arrested 3-4 times. The spurious allegations, you know, he's kidnapped one of us at this time. He imprisoned us at his home another time. And the police were absolutely very happy to come along and to arrest me. We were already totally demoralized, very low, isolated, cars torched, cars bricked, windows torched, windows bricked. And then the police are arresting you, and because you're depressed, you're psychologically, you're down, you're out, and so this is the kind of stuff that we suffered the first 7 years. We became very, accepting of our fate, if you like, and then we were forced out in 2006, actually. Prior to being forced out, if I can backtrack, and it's a very poignant point and how I've come to know the bishops, and is that the advisor, Justin Welby, came along armed with a news reporter. And I now know that I was suffering with PTSD going back all that time, sort of, you know. And this is in 2005, so around sort of 2000 to 2005, he comes along, very self-assured, this academic, Philip Lewis, and I was crashing out 6-7 times a day, having to sort of work, keep myself alive, my family, actually. And then this man comes along and he's talking to Kubra, and he's writing things down. He might as well be interrogating her. I've come down in my no-nonsense approach. He's introduced himself and as the bishop's advisor, David James, and at that time. And he's telling me, you know, that they've come and to listen and to talk. And I thought, you know, okay. It's taking you long enough, but fine. How did they come to know that you had converted? And he got my back up, actually. And I said, what does it matter how they found out? He mentioned the word community. And I said, I don't see it as a community, sir. I'm born and raised here. I don't see them as a community. I see myself as English. With a heritage, yes, but what do you mean how they found out? What does it matter? He looked a bit sheepish then, and the seasoned journalist, he looked at him very, very fiercely, actually, and then he put his pen and sort of pad down, and he said, look, let us use the bishop's office. And he set up a meeting with the bishop. Prior to which, the black church I was involved in at the time, the pastor was knocking on Muslim leaders' doors locally, roundabout. Nobody would open the door, nobody would entertain him. And then the bishop comes back a few weeks later. We have this meeting, we're called in, and the Jamaican pastor's with me. And I had a journalist, he was born again. He said, listen, I'm from a high Anglican church. I've been commissioned to do the story. Why don't I come along with you? I could be of value. I said, please do. We got there at a meeting, and this gentleman, David James, is very angry with me for reporting him to the papers. I said, no, I just merely said you knew of my situation, you know, and I've not said anything wrong about you. And the gentleman said, the journalist said to him, I think Nisar Souza is a leader of Christendom. He looked quite bewildered. And then the next question he posed to him was, would you welcome converts to your church? He said, yes, that is to say no. And I was just dumbfounded. And he said, the reason for that is we don't have the houses and the resources. Bearing in mind, just some months prior, we had taken refuge in a vicarage because they tried torching me out of my home. I was met by the ringleader. He was waiting for me, and I came out of my car. Didn't know your movements. And he said to me, "Why don't you move?" And I just looked at him, actually. And I said, "If it's God's will, I move." And he said, "You've seen us. We've torched your car. I'm going to burn you out of your home." So I said, "Well, if it's the Lord's will, you burn me out of my home." And I went indoors, reported to the sergeant, spoke to him directly. And he said to me, "Stop trying to be a crusader and move out of your home." So there was this general theme that I should move away. None of the perpetrators were arrested. Some of them were my neighbors. The car torchings, you know, you name it, it just wasn't happening with the police. So back to the meeting, the Jamaican pastor leapt to his feet. He was livid with the man. And he almost put his finger, when he was wagging it around, into his nose, and he said, "All you're fit for is appeasing the Muslims." So we left with nothing, and from my understanding, years later, they actually, is it some kind of Anglican Times, they actually reported that the fact that they had resolved my issues or something, you know, it's just, this is the God's truth. Just fairly recently, I stumbled across that article, and I thought, goodness me, you know, talk about Judas, you know. And it's got from bad to worse. So we were literally forced out in June of 2006 to the house I've now left under armed police protection. And so we went about rebuilding our lives. We had five children. Isaac came along 9 years ago. And we, as I say, we were traumatized, suffering trauma. But I was adamant we'd moved away. We set about rebuilding our lives in another part of Bradford. It was September of 2008, we got involved with the Dispatches documentary in relation to highlighting the plight of converts. Naturally, being very, very passionate about this thing and the suffering of my brothers and sisters, as we've come to know since my Christian walk in Pakistan, prior to which I had no idea. And actually, is that I... contributed. They said, "We'll disguise your face." I said, "There's no point, because they all know. It's kind of like wildfire. And even if they don't know, I wish to stand up and to be counted." Sometimes I struggle with that, actually. But then, you know, being the measure of the person that I am, no. Even fairly recently, one of the girls self-harmed, the youngest girl, ended up in hospital. She's well now. It's just a cry for help. It's just been a tremendous slog. And my oldest daughter, she actually said that to me. She said, it's your fault, you know. And I said, no, Annie, it's not my fault. I serve my Lord and Saviour. You know, you go and pray in your closet and you go and have it out with your Lord. You know, if I was in Pakistan or the Middle East, I could accept my fate. How can you tell me, you know, that it's my fault, born and raised in a Christian country, in a democratic country? I refuse to accept that. And she obviously said it because my youngest daughter, actually, she was out for the count, and there was pandemonium, actually, you know. So one can just go on and on, but the fact is actually that after this documentary, this is like 2 years we've been relatively free. You have the usual idiots and sort of people that we bump into know us, actually, and are telling shopkeepers that they shouldn't be serving my wife after Kubra's walked out. The following day she's gone, a few days later, and the Muslim shopkeepers turned around and said, "Look, I know you're Christian because so-and-so was behind you," and they said, "I shouldn't serve you." You know, and so they are, you know, some decent-minded Muslims, as you were saying, Chris, that we should mar them all the same. But there is this divine law that tells them that we are now apostates, and Muhammad decreed that anybody who leaves Islam should have his head lopped off. That's it. 17 years ago, I was with my oldest son. He was 7/8, so Annie was a few years younger than him, and I walked in to get a video for us, and he said to me, he just tore into me, and he said, "If you're in the Middle East or Pakistan, I'd be the first to chop off your head." This was 17 years ago. So you can just imagine what's happened since that time. And so back to where we are, this new location. So the program's gone out now. And of course, this Muslim family, doors away, this extended family then start with their hostilities, the shunning, as I call it. Actually, just turn the back. Fine, I can live with that. But no, it's then the classic case of, we need to get him out of this area. We need to sort of, you know, cleanse him from out of this road, out of this area, actually. And so, and it starts all over again, and it gets to the point where, again, we're just literally annihilated. And there is so much to tell you, but in essence, it boils down to the fact that I was kneecapped and suffered a broken hand coming out of my home, November of 2015. I'd reported to the police. There was complaints as long as my arm to the police with his family. They're well connected with George Galloway. They're well connected with his new MP. All the Muslim councillors are the best of buddies. You are an apostate. You've abandoned the faith. It's what you deserve. It's what you should get. You know, it's just the most incredible, you know, sort of scenario that, you know, on the surface they might say, oh, you know, we're doing all we can for him, you know, but they are conspiring actually and part of this ideology that, you know, we should kill the man, you know. And so often I've pondered, you know, what kind of religion is this that needs to kill its own children? And so as much as I've stood, but sadly the bishops, Nick Baines, oftentimes I've had to turn off the radio for this sort of slot, this religious slot that they come on and talk the talk. He's on frontline Kurdistan, you know, he's campaigning for the religious rights of, you know, the Kurdish people or whatever it is, you know. I've been literally on their doorstep, 5-minute bus drive, and the Bishop's Palace is just there, you know. And of course, was it Mary I was talking to? And it seems to have opened up, you know, all these scenarios where I'm at a focus convention going back in 2014. Somebody thought they'd do me a favour by inviting me to these wonderful southerners, you know, these southern sort of Anglican churches at Camber Sands. And there's Mr. Welby strutting his stuff, actually, and I find it hard to contain myself. But then on one occasion, this black bishop, Bishop Josiah, was called to speak, and they were celebrating him, you know, actually, that he's on some kind of ecumenical interfaith dialogue and being promoted to the world arena. And I'm sat there, and I thought, right, I'm going to go and speak to him, actually. And so I've legged it, and I've jumped onto the podium. This is after he's been prayed for, of course, and he was engaged with another fellow African. And I've walked and said, excuse me, Bishop Josiah, my name is Nissar Hussain. We're being annihilated, and our lives are in danger, actually. And the bishops in Bradford have turned their back on me, and he was speechless. And I noticed from the peripheral of my eye, Justin Welby dash onto the podium. He obviously saw me. He knew who I was. We were the only Asian family there out of 4,000 people. And the Christian lady that got us there, I think, would have said to him, look, could you get this man and his family a chalet? They need a break. This is who they are. So they knew, obviously, of me. And as he's walking towards me and looking a wee bit anxious, and as he got a bit closer, he stuck out his hands. I said, please, to meet you, Miss Welby. I need 2 minutes of your time. We're facing a very serious dilemma in Bradford. And he said, nothing, and he got Mr. Josiah by the hand, and just as slightly in where I said, you know, please, can you give me 2 minutes of time? I need to discuss with you what's going on. I'm a convert from a Muslim background. and we're being failed miserably. No, we do know we can. And I said, but you're not. And he said, no, yes, we are. Go and speak to Toby Howarth, the new bishop. He's a brilliant man. And I said, no, but they have turned their back on me. And before I knew it, I was blocked by some of their people. And off he went. And that's how it is, actually. And so it took a lot after the attack. I went to my car. These thugs had been obviously waiting for me. I got sidetracked. Somebody shouted, I looked over, it was these Polish neighbours of mine, these young men, several houses up the road. And next thing I know, as I turned around, I was just being pummeled by thugs wielding pickaxe handles. And after several blows, I then backed up, and then they squared onto me, and this one blow went to the side of my head. It's quite a miracle, actually, Chris. It's just like literally a puppet on a string, and that very precise second, and you can see the CCTV footage, I've blocked it. Well, the Lord's got my hand up there. My hand literally exploded with the force, and it reeled me backwards with the force of the hit, and the back of my heel caught the curb, and I fell backwards, and I hit the back of my head onto the wall. I was concussed. And they started pummeling me again. They fractured my kneecap. They were setting about the other one. And these Polish chappies come along, save the day. These cowards then sort of jump in the car and drive off. I spent 11 days in hospital. No Christian besides a mother and father in the Lord, Jenny and Brian Lancaster, God bless them, who came. But 11 days, my wife was going about a house, walking up and down the road and sort of coming to see me in hospital. Not one phone call, not one visit. This is how it's been for us in the 17 years, from church to church to church. And it's just been one of isolation. Christians are terrified of, by way of association. And so we've had to learn to just get on with it by ourselves. My wife's been absolutely remarkable. This family, very well connected, thuggish, loutish behavior, loitering, made it a no-go area. The last year or so, couldn't even walk out the front door without them just waiting to swear, shout, intimidate, using all sorts of other thugs, smashed cars, couldn't park the car. The only place it was safe was in the police station. And so, nothing prepared us for the fact that we had then, last November, 10 armed officers. They blocked off the front road, the back, and I was in the garden, heard some commotion, and Kubra was near the gate, and so she opened the door, the back gate, rod. They came, it was surreal, it was like something out of a movie, you know, this SWAT team. And where's Nisar? She pointed and said, and then next thing I know, they're raiding over to the control room. Yes, sir, we have him in our sights. He's here. He's okay. And we're now going to engage with him, debrief him. And I thought, what's going on here? So, there's an imminent threat to your life. We need to take you in. We need to brief you. Could you kindly open the front door and let our other officers in? And when my wife opened the door, they spilled in. Cars outside, X5, you know, armed officers outside. Nobody could walk past. Nobody could look out the windows. They were shouting and yelling. And they now want to move us into a safe house. And that very day, we left our home in Bradford. And this is where we are at this moment in time, actually. And despite all the apparent, information, to this day they've not told me who was arrested, what have they done. It's just that I understand there might be threats or whatever, but however, we believe it's just another part of the police collusion and corruption to get us out of there, actually. And it never ceases to amaze me, actually, how, the failure of the police, church leadership, counsellors who are Muslim, I don't have any faith in them anyway, this new one, Naz Shah. So, you know, it's a very, could I have envisaged it have come to this? No. But one thing I will say very loud and clear, and I'll shout at the rooftops, if it wasn't for Brother Patrick, I actually phoned him and said, I'm in need and we need to get into a home, and the area we're going to, I need to purchase, I'm short of money. And I left a message for him. He got back to me no time at all. And isn't it ironic how it takes a convert to know a convert that he pledged a substantial amount of money. Yes, I hope by the grace of God that I will pay back, because it's my duty to support my fellow convert brothers and sisters. Actually, but he's been faithful, and they've always come through for us when it's mattered. They've wrote off cars, smashed cars, they've immobilized us, and he's always, you know, phoned me and said, Nisar, we're going to make this contribution. So there is no place where I wouldn't stand and thank Patrick Sukdeo, the Barnabas Fund team. I consider them my family. But unfortunately, there is a grave, grave issue in this country. And I'm very, very deeply saddened at the response of the likes of Mr. Welby. I can certainly tell you the bishops in Bradford as well. And I just feel that, you know, the most Christians are being duped. No doubt it's to do with this interfaith ecumenicalism. But I can assure you, actually, this appeasement, actually, it's not working. There are many thousands of converts who are terrified because there are consequences, you see. They're dispossessed, they lose families, if they're not threatened with their lives, who's going to stand for them, actually? Justin Welby is not standing for them. He was in Sudan, from my understanding. And if I backtrack before that, he was from the Barnabas Fund, it doesn't surprise me at least, that he's welcoming this father and son imam team, Chris, if you correct me if I'm wrong. And there he is in his finest garb, embracing them outside church house. The very people that are advocating blasphemy law. You saw a picture of Aisha Bibi. They're butchering my brothers and sisters. They're raping and pillaging the women. 700-800 rapes, forced marriages through childbearing and such like. Why aren't they speaking up? You know, maybe it affects their, you know, reserve sensitivities, the interfaith dialogue, and all that. You know, one can go on and on, actually, you know. So keep us in your prayers. Please pray for Barnabas. There is no place that I wouldn't go to give my support, certainly. Unfortunately, you know, I'm a refugee with my family in my own country. So it's very difficult for me. I have officially been diagnosed with PTSD. I don't read too much into it. It's just a case for us that having a young family that we've had to just press on, get on with it, actually. There is no time for complacency, but so please keep us in your prayers. God bless you all. Thank you.